I was sent a cartoon recently depicting a familiar Christmas scene, a beloved Christmas scene, the line to Santa Claus in the department store. Anybody been there recently? I don't miss the line, but anyway, it was the line in the department store, and a young child was sitting there in Santa's lap with his eyes closed and a finger raised as if for emphasis. And he tells a bemused Santa, "All I want for Christmas is a deeper understanding of the historicity of the infancy narratives in the Synoptic Gospels." I don't know why I get these cartoons. I don't know what that's about. But in the bubble over Santa's head are these words. Let me guess. Preacher's kid? Probably a preacher has been reading a little too much Marcus Borg. You will not be surprised to learn that, according to the Pew Research Center, 65% of Americans believe in all of the basic elements of the birth stories of the Gospels, including the virgin birth, which is more than the percentage of people who believe in evolution. More than the percentage of people who believe in global warming, more than the percentage of those who believe in the efficacy of vaccines. Do we have work to do or what? I know, y'all are shaking your head like, I don't believe that. Check it out online. At least part of the problem is that for many, there appear to be only two alternatives to dealing with stories like the birth of Jesus. Either you believe all of it, literally, word for word, or it's a children's story. It's a fable, and it ought to be dismissed. Last week, retired classics professor James D. wrote an editorial for the Austin American Statesman on the Exodus story. Perhaps some of you caught that. My colleague John Wright at First Methodist has dubbed James D. the Grinch who stole Christmas, because Professor D. writes these columns around this time of year. He was writing this in light of the release of the movie Exodus, Gods and Kings. So we'll skip the part in the column where he pans the movie while confessing that he hasn't actually seen the movie. And we'll move to his main point, which is that there is very, very slim historical evidence to support most of the elements of the Exodus story. This should not be a newsflash for anyone paying attention. And Professor D. has the scant evidence of 250 years of historical critical research to back him up. In his conclusion, he leaves us with one question, one that I suppose you could apply to any of our sacred stories. "It's a simple matter of conscience," he writes. "Do you choose reality and truth or fairy tales and falsehood?" How would you respond to such a withering critique of stories that are so central to our faith? What would you say? Here's what I would say. It is a matter of conscience, and I choose reality and truth. The real question, though, is what kind of truth are we talking about here? I mean, if you look seriously at the infancy narratives of the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, there is little doubt that while there is a kernel of historical truth, many of the details of the stories, shepherds in the field, angel choirs, magi who come from the east, a star moving across the heavens, these details say more about the storytellers and about the early church than they do about what really happened at the level of historical fact. But there's a further question to ask. Who cares? Who cares if there were angel choirs in the sky or if it was a bunch of girls who came from neighboring Sepphoris who sang? Who cares if there were 3 kings or 1,003? We can argue until the cows come home about what really happened on that day. But what mattered to those who first heard those stories was what those stories meant and how they resonated in their lives and what they mean now in our communities of faith. Why did people tell and retell these stories? To report matter of fact what happened? Just wanted you to be sure again that the shepherds were not at the local tavern. They were out in the fields tending the sheep. Is that why they were told? Or was it because they saw something more, something deeper, something with the power to shape lives and to transform whole communities? Can you even think of the Exodus story without also thinking of the movement to end slavery or the civil rights movement and the power that those stories had to shape those movements? What matters to me in the infancy narrative, one thing is how they chasten my ideas about what's really important and who's on top. Most of the time I think I'll find God with the kings and the princes and the scholars. But the stories remind me that God will be found, no, not there, but in the backwater with the poor and the lowly. To paraphrase Joseph Campbell, these stories talk about a truth so large, so important, so mysterious that they cannot be contained by mere facts. These stories explode beyond the historical facts. For the Christian community, these stories are not therefore children's fables to be discarded once we reach adulthood. But they are, in the words of Campbell, the secret opening through which the inexhaustible energies of the cosmos pour into human manifestation. That's truth for me, and that's reality. Last Christmas Eve, I was greeted by one of our retired pastors out there in the North Narthex. It was after the late worship service, and he told me with a catch in his throat, "Even though I know none of these stories happened exactly as they're written, they move me to tears and to the most profound joy every single year I hear them." Amen? All of which brings us to our story this morning, Mary's yes to God. I thought about this text as I watched our children's pageant last Sunday in worship, and perhaps like you, I remembered back to pageants that I had participated in. We had a huge pageant at the church that I grew up in Toronto. It had like a 2-week run to it, and tickets were sold, and a huge cast, and I mean real costumes. We had these beards if you got an actual part, you know, because we were all young teenagers or you know, pre-whatever, and we didn't have beards, and so you had this awful glue that you stuck the beards on with, and a script that went considerably beyond the scriptural stories, and there was an angel choir, there was a gauze curtain that they dropped down, and then these angel choir of children that sang, and it was really something. So at about 12 or 13, I got up the courage to audition for a part, and I was cast as Joseph. Yes. Ooh, which sounds really impressive until you realize that in this particular Christmas pageant, Joseph had no lines. So I'm sure this was before I had this beautiful bass baritone voice that I had, some squeaky in-between voice. I was paired with a girl who was about my age. She was Mary. And we had to hold hands as we came up what seemed like the longest aisle in the world. And we came up toward the inn, which was set at the front of the church. I was still at that age where I thought that girls were kind of gross, and it was a particular relief to me that the story was about a virgin birth. Just think about it, you'll get it later if you don't get it right now. In our pageant, we had a marvelous annunciation scene with a dramatically festooned angel with huge wings, and I think they even dropped the angel down from something to onto the floor, and not literally dropped, but lowered the angel. And it never occurred to me to wonder as I watched that scene about how quickly Mary said, "Yes. Let it be to me according to your word." I mean, it just seems so obvious, right? I mean, here is God's angel, and that God's angel is asking her to take on a mission, and we know the end of that story, and we know how important it all was for the salvation of humanity. And so, what choice did Mary have but to say yes? As an adult, though, I find Mary's response a bit puzzling, a little unearthly, a bit removed from the way that we move with our decisions and puzzle over them, and we weigh all the pluses and minuses. I'm wondering if maybe we got the short version of the story. Maybe there was a little bit more pondering on her part, pondering this decision. I'm hoping the angel said, "Listen, Mary, I mean, take your time. This is a big one, okay? I can come back in a couple of days. Call me." Mary's yes is, it's so unreal, but it's also deeply true. When we say yes, especially yes to God, we never know. We never know all that is contained in there of wonder and of struggle. There's a popular contemporary Christian song, "Mary, Did You Know?" Don't worry, I'm not going to sing it, okay? The song recites all the things that Mary couldn't possibly have known when she said yes to the angel. "Mary, did you know that your baby boy would save our sons and daughters?" I mean, some of it would lift her up, and some of it would pierce her to the heart. What Mary could not have known was that she would have to cling to that yes when she announced the news of her pregnancy to her parents, when she walked outside and she faced the gossip mongers of Austin, I mean of Nazareth, when she talked about God and an angel appearing to her and people questioned her sanity. What Mary could have not have ever known was that her baby boy would liberate the lowly and oppressed, that he would fill the hungry with good things, that he would knock all of the bigwigs off their thrones and raise up the ones who thought they were of no account. I recently read about James Cromwell, an interview with him. He played supporting actor to a pig named Babe. Anybody see that movie? Wonderful movie. The movie Babe became a huge hit, and it launched Cromwell's career into the stratosphere. He almost turned the movie down. But he said in saying yes to a movie that seemed doomed from the beginning, seriously, a movie about a pig that talks and it herds dogs? I mean, okay, whatever, I'll do it, I guess. I'm desperate. But the movie actually changed his life. He said that the animals that were front and center in the movie began to take a central place in his life. He became a vegan during the movie. He's now a huge advocate for animal welfare. He has championed a myriad of animal protection causes, from research to factory farming, even how animals are used in entertainment. Now, when James Cromwell said yes, do you think that he saw all of that coming? I don't think so. When you say yes, especially when you say yes to God, be careful. Warning. Our culture teaches us, our Christian culture teaches us, saying yes to God, it's all goodness and light. And yes, there are riches beyond measure, but in the aftermath of yes, think of Mary, nothing will ever quite be the same. What Mary could not have known is that contained in that simple yes was a glorious universe of blessing and revolution. She couldn't have known all of that, but apparently she knew just enough to get started, to trust that her yes is grounded in God's yes. This is good to know. This is good stuff to know. Because the angels of God are still calling. They're still doing their work. The work of bearing God into the world, Mary's work, continues with you and me. And every time we whisper, yes, yes, we enter more fully into the life of God. And our lives and the whole world trembles with possibility and promise. Amen.